The Black Friday numbers are in and spending is up. And yet, for some reason, people still feel poor. So is economic anxiety driving people to socialism? Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. Happy Cyber Monday. I'm your host, Peter Suderman. And today I am joined by Catherine Mangu-Ward, Matt Welch, and Nick Gillespie. All right, so Catherine, I want to start with you here. There's all of these economic indicators that show that people are richer than ever, that they're spending more than ever on Black Friday, that, you know, in many ways, not all, but in many ways, the economy is doing well. And yet, economic anxiety is everywhere. It is just driving so much of our politics and our discourse. People seem to feel, if not quite poor, then unstable and uncertain about their future. Why do people feel so poor if they're so rich?
They're rich, but their future is unstable and uncertain. Like, people are right, actually. And the reason for that is because of the political risk that is built into our economic system. We have a bunch of idiots in charge of crucial institutions and crucial industries, including and especially healthcare and education, that are government actors who do what they want and who aren't responsive to economic signals in the way that we would like them to be. So people are right that they have money now, and also that they can't count on that money being worth as much as they think it will be, or they can't count on that money buying what it can currently buy in the future. And that is because our politics suck.
And yet, you can take this too far. So there was this viral essay on Substack, a version of which was reprinted in the Free Press over the holiday weekend here by Michael Green, basically arguing that $140,000 was the real poverty line, and that if you weren't making $140,000 a year in America, effectively, you were poor. Nick, I know there's a lot of debunkings of this, but what did you think of this essay?
I think he's off. I think you need to be making $280,000. a year in order to be poor.
All right, that's the real number,
folks. That's the ante into the poor club. That, you know, two things about that essay. One, it is fundamentally idiotic and stupid, and it has been, contradicted, I think, factually and theoretically. By any number of people. I'm particular to the critiques of Scott Winship and Jeremy Horpital that just show this is, you know, fundamentally wrong on every possible level. So that's one thing that's really important to keep in mind, that materially people are doing better than ever, and even poor people are doing better than they were 10 or 20 years ago. Having said that, the fact that it struck a chord with people, that is something that's worth thinking about. And I think what it mostly says is that people in the media business in particular, and people who are coastal elites, to echo what Catherine is saying, are terrified that their lives are going to go down the drain sometime soon. There is no reason to believe that that's true, but that is the anxiety that it's tapping into, of a kind of educated elite that worries that, you know, when it comes down to it, not only can Trump and a bunch of other people in both the Republican and Democratic Party take our standards of living down, you know, an order of magnitude, through stupid policies, but also that technology and change can come for those of us who are in the top, whatever, you know, 25% of income earners, 10% of income earners, et cetera. That's what is new. And that's what's undergirding, I think, the anxiety that you're seeing that gets talked about in places like Twitter and other media centric forums.
So it's vibes-based economic anxiety,
Point out Gallup, you know, does something that's very helpful. For decades now, they've asked people, like, how are you doing in your life? You know, how are things going in your personal life, and how are things going in the U.S.? Currently, the last time that Gallup did that, it was about 80% of people said things are going pretty well. That they're satisfied with how things are going in their life. It's 21% who say that about the U.S. That disjuncture is pretty constant. So on a certain level, we should not pay too much attention to this. But on another level, we always should, because when people feel unstable, and particularly people who are influential and can change policy or have the ear of policymakers, you got to watch out for that, because they're living in a delusional land where everything is about to, you know, get swept out to sea.
Go back a year or so, a little more than a year, to when Joe Biden was president. And people were, you know, the big biggest complaint during the election last year was that people were upset about the economy. And, you know, they'd gone through a huge amount of inflation under Joe Biden, the highest inflation in 40 years. There were real underlying, there's measurable problems with the economy. And yet whenever the Biden administration was presented with people are upset about this, they pointed out a bunch of numbers that showed that actually things were okay. And they were like, you're wrong. Your perception is wrong. And now what we see is the Trump administration is doing this. I mean, Trump did basically that, was like, oh, these numbers are all fake. Like, there's nothing, you know, the sentiment is all fake. This is just the fake media, right? In an interview with Fox News. And that seems like a political problem for the Trump administration, which ran on, we're going to fix the economy. Matt, is this what should Trump be doing here? Even if you think the economy is in good shape in a bunch of ways, even if you think people are kind of hyperventilating or sort of misreading a bunch of these numbers, if people feel bad about the economy, if the vibes are off, politicians have to pay attention to that, right?
It's not just vibes. It's how much money do you have after everything else is done, right? Which is kind of the one of the bases of the idiotic $140,000 essay, is that it didn't really correct for where do you live? How much does it cost? Which kind of is important in these things. The Trump administration, what they should do is undo increasing import taxes by 500%, the average rate of import taxes. I mean, it's not surprising, but still kind of incredible that he did indeed campaign on stuff is too expensive, let's make stuff less expensive. And he also campaigned on let's do all the tariffs. Because tariffs, see, they make stuff more expensive. And so when you do a lot of them, stuff is more expensive. It's amazing to me that there isn't a place.
Genius.
Even after
put that on a bumper sticker.
Election of Zohran Mamdani, who famously ran on affordability as a concept, not necessarily as the result of what his policies are going to be. But it's amazing that people can win elections on the cost of things, and yet there is no, at this time in our two-party system, any space for a sizable block that says, you know what, everything that makes things cost more, we're against that. We are for the things that make things cost less, because unlike, you know, the French academics who wrote a book in 2009 called No Low Cost, we're yes low cost. Americans are very sensitive to pretty marginal, pretty small, single digit even, rates of annual inflation. They're going to be sensitive to price increases as well and feel like they have less money after spending on whatever. That could be college education and other things. And so you can look around and say, oh, this sales tax, that makes this thing more expensive. Maybe not have them. This property tax, this, you know, borrowing $1 trillion a year on the federal level to service the debt, completely wasted money. Maybe that makes things more expensive. Sending, you know, entitlements to Donald Trump and other rich people who don't need them. That makes everything more expensive. Regulations obviously make things more expensive, too. So eventually there might be some space for that. Currently, it is not expressed at all in the two-party system, because the populist response to this is to figure out who to hate, when what they should hate really are the policies that make every single thing more expensive. And that, yes, includes tariffs.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of interesting overlap with what's going on with the Trump administration and the MAGA right now, and what happened during the Biden administration, where the Biden administration came in with all these antitrust hipsters. And their basic, like their fundamental view of the world was, we should use the power of government, right, to break up these big companies in order to increase competitiveness. And we should give up on the antitrust standard that has ruled for 40 or 50 years, which is known as the consumer welfare standard. Consumer welfare standard, like if you want to understand it, is basically, is this good for consumers? And every time the Biden administration tried to do something that was outside of the consumer welfare standard, that like wasn't just directly good for consumers, people hated it. They hated it. They hated having higher prices. They didn't care about like academic theories and competitiveness. And like they just wanted stuff to be cheap and cost of living to go down. But I worry, and that drove them to Trump, right? Like that drove them to MAGA. MAGA and to Trump's message. And that is one reason, I think, why Donald Trump is in the White House today. But I worry that we are now seeing the opposite effect, Catherine. There is a poll out from Rasmussen just showing that 51% of likely voters aged 18 to 39 support a Democratic socialist candidate for the 2028 election. And one reason why is pretty clear. It's like the thing that is driving people to socialism is that they are upset with the economy. They feel like it's not working.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that, unfortunately, the American public doesn't wake up, notice that their TVs are more expensive, and become libertarian. I would love that. That would be super cool if that happened.
Because TVs are actually cheaper. The speakers that are much more expensive.
But they're more expensive than they would have been because of bad public policy still. And so I think that it makes sense to me that, you know, what we're getting is just throw the bums out energy. That's what brought Trump in. That's what will bring in his successor. And that's a proud American tradition, right? Like, never discount the fact that, like, mostly Americans do just like to take the guy who was in power and throw him out on whatever pretense occurs to them. If Mamdani is the kind of archetypal American democratic socialist in 2025, it's not that socialist is one thing that is sort of good news.
I mean, he has become less socialist
right.
over the years, acknowledging political reality.
He did that in part because he was trying to be electable. And so if the thing that Americans say they want is democratic socialism, but the thing that the democratic socialists are doing is becoming less and less socialist in order to get elected, I guess, it's all bad news. But that particular bit of bad news doesn't make me panic in quite that way.
Nick, one thing I've been thinking about through this episode is just, like, is everything inflation, right? Like, go back to the Milei, the Argentina election, right, which wasn't, Milei was not on the ballot, but, like, in many ways, his policies were. He brought down inflation. He was vindicated by voters, right? Go back to 1980, and Reagan was like, Carter's driven inflation up. That's bad. I'm going to fix that. After a couple of years, inflation went down and he won landslide victory in 1984. Right. Is it just kind of like the whole it's not even it's the economy stupid. It's just it's inflation stupid.
I'm not sure. I mean, Reagan oversaw between 1979 and 1983 or 84 when he got reelected. There was a substantial change in the rate of inflation, but also in economic productivity. There had been a super severe recession that basically got Reagan elected and got him able to pass a bunch of tax cuts that he ended up having to rescind. So material reality matters. I think what's most interesting and what's different today is that the economy is much more volatile, and certainly the stock market is, which is kind of a vibe indicator of things. It keeps going up, but the swings get broader, over time. I mean, earlier this year, when Trump threw the switch on Liberation Day, the stock market indexes fell by about 25%. They're well past that again. So things are good. People have a memory of recession, which keeps things going. To go back to this question of why would people under 40 be in favor of a democratic socialist? If you go look at that Rasmussen poll, which was commissioned by the Heartland Institute, the leading indicator of why younger voters say they want, they would be happy to see a democratic socialist become president in 2028, 27% said because their parents told them that it would be a good thing. So what, this is where it's really important to, recognize everything that Catherine said and Matt said. Absolutely correct. We should have government policies that are always aimed at making things cheaper and less, less expensive because of government dictate, and just saying like, okay, we're going to give you a bunch of stuff. And in order to pay for that kind of, we're going to tax all of the things that you want. And don't worry, it'll work out in the end. Like, that's bad policy. But a big part of this is, when we shift from things like I am starving or I don't have enough food or I am unhoused to affordability, that's a shift in vibe where it's like, what I really want is to spend less on rent. It's not that I can't make rent, but I would rather spend 15 or 20% less. That always makes sense. Consumers should always be looking to spend less money for better quality products. But that's very distinct. Places like New York, they're not losing people because it's too expensive. People are kind of pissed off. The services should be better. The prices can be lower. But that's very different than saying, like, things are actually getting worse for a majority of Americans. And to go back to that kind of, you know, that ridiculous article that the Free Press, you know, reprinted and has been, you know, completely taken apart, you still hear people saying, well, you know, that the thesis of that piece is wrong. Like, it's so fundamentally wrong, but it catches something. And what it catches is that people are, you know, unsettled by the volatility that has been introduced mostly by politicians. So if you got rid of, if Trump actually, you know, kept his attention on the same thing for 5 minutes and it wasn't trying to kill Venezuelans who, you know, on boats, maybe people would settle down a little bit.
The problem with that essay, I think, at heart is that what it said was, if you're making less than $140,000, you're poor. You're in poverty. And in fact, even in, like, if you look at the basket of goods that it said, right, was going to cost $135,000, $140,000, it's a middle class lifestyle. It's basically, right, it is an article that, like, on its, like, when you actually look at what it is saying, what it is saying is it costs $140,000 to have a very comfortable middle class lifestyle in America. And, like, yeah, that sounds about right. But that's very different than saying the real poverty line is $140,000. All right, we're going to talk about the boat strikes here in just a moment. But before we go, a couple of house ads here. We have a webathon coming up where you can ask us anything. It's going to be live on YouTube this Thursday, 2:30 p.m. Catherine, Matt, Robbie Suave, and me, we're going to take questions about anything you can think of. So that means our favorite science fiction novels, what it's like to work at Reason. I've talked about all the personal stuff you can ask us on this pod, but you should ask us about politics, about policy, about the media, about free speech. We're going to have Robbie Suave, who writes a lot about this stuff, right? So ask us your wonky policy questions. You name it, we will answer it. Send your questions to podcasts@reason.com with the word at webathon in the subject line. That's podcasts@reason.com. We also have another debate coming up next week on December 10th, Wednesday, December 10th, here in Washington, D.C. Big tech does more good than harm. That's the resolution that's going to be up for debate. It's going to be Robbie Suave and Elizabeth Nolan Brown versus Emily Jashinsky and Ryan Grimm. Reason is going to take the side of big tech, say it's doing more good than harm. Emily and Ryan are going to be against that. That is going to be Wednesday, December 10th, here in Washington, D.C. at the Miracle Theater. You can get tickets at reason.com/versus. Reason.com/versus. Tickets are going fast, so check in now. We'll be back in just a moment. This show is sponsored by Donors Trust. Earlier this year, Donald Trump signed a new tax bill into law, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. The law largely keeps Trump's 2017 tax cuts in place, but there are important changes to the tax code coming in 2026. That's next year. And that means your charitable giving before December 31st really matters. If you support local charities or libertarian nonprofits like the Reason Foundation, the Cato Institute, or others, then now is the time to think strategically. With the right planning, you might be able to reduce your taxes, simplify your giving, maybe even give more than you thought was possible. That's why our friends at Donors Trust created A Libertarian's Guide to 2025 Year-End Giving. It's clear, it's practical, and it'll help you take the headache out of your year-end giving and make the most of your philanthropy before the new rules kick in. Visit donorstrust.org/reason to learn more and download their year-end giving guide. That's donorstrust.org/reason. Well, it's not just Donald Trump's poll numbers that are sinking. They keep blowing up boats. Yeah, I'm sorry. And it's bad. It's real bad. These are at best extrajudicial killings. And now it looks like it may be war crimes as well. The Washington Post published a report basically saying that after one of these strikes in September, they went back for a second strike to kill survivors who were clearly not able to respond in any way. Even folks like Andy McCarthy are saying this is a war crime at minimum, and maybe just flat out murder, because these people are criminals, but they are not enemy combatants in a war. So Matt, what do we do here? What is the remedy? Like, where does the power lie to stop this sort of thing? Because we've been talking about this for months now, and Donald Trump just keeps taking down drug boats, alleged drug boats, with absolutely no justification or even really an argument to the public at all.
So before this happened, or before the Washington Post story came out, Senate voted on whether Trump should have the ability to do this or whether he needed to go authorization through them. And it went down by a very, very narrow margin, 51 to 49. So what can we do? Well, one thing is to, if we include the United States Senate, which I don't know, maybe not, but we might know a couple of people, then we should keep voting on that until the vote is correct. There's nothing that stops the legislative branch from acting like a legislative branch that has constitutional prerogatives when it comes to the waging of war. And so they should keep doing that. We as humans, citizens who aren't necessarily really into this, should call things by their proper names. And this is extrajudicial killings. This is apparently war crime. And this, we're just murdering people. I mean, like, it's not, we're just shooting people that we could stop and and frisk in the open seas. And we are deciding not to, as Rand Paul has pointed out to us and other people, that one out of every four of those boats in general that we suspect of carrying drugs is found upon search to not have any. So is that a death rate that we're comfortable with? 21 bombings now, 84, 83 people just killed who we haven't declared war against. And the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, is out there like flashing dank memes on Twitter about being a cartoon character doing explodey boats. It's really a disgrace. And so one thing that you can do as a citizen is mention this. You can write a letter to aforementioned senators and ask them to vote upon this. And that's about all we can do until there is a time and a place to launch war crimes proceedings, which there should be. Pete Hegseth, in my estimation, is guilty of war crimes, or at least heavily suspected in them, and he doesn't give a shit. He's absolutely trying to brazen this one out. It's disgusting, and I feel embarrassed about it and sickened by it. And I think that that's an appropriate level of revulsion and disgust at this.
So we should say here that Hegseth has kind of, sort of denied the Post's report, saying that it is fabricated, inflammatory, and derogatory reporting. We didn't actually directly address the allegations in the Post report. Instead, just said, well, basically, our actions in the Caribbean are legal and lawful under international law. But doesn't this whole thing just sort of suggest that the Trump administration feels bound by kind of no morality, no law, no ethic here in a way that is dangerous in the Caribbean, obviously, is illegal, is awful, but also has larger justifications? Matthew Petty, even before all of this broke, wrote that the administration's position on these drug boat strikes can justify almost anything the government wants to do to anyone. I mean, this is really worrying stuff, even if you are not a drug runner in the Caribbean.
Yeah, and it's of a piece with the Trump administration's actions towards illegal immigrants or allegedly illegal immigrants and things like that, where the activity is not only unjustified but oftentimes is incompetent on top of it. How many of the people that were killed on drug boats, alleged drug boats, are going to turn out to be completely innocent. That remains to be seen. And that's separate from the question of if they were drug runners and they are, they're basically made defenseless and then you kill them. That's the war crime. I think there is, what is being revealed in the Trump administration 2.0 is an absolute disinterest in constitutional limits to government and accountability either to the electorate or to Congress. The courts are going through all of this and they are doing a decent job of reeling in the Trump administration. But I think we need more than that. And I'll also add that, Pete Hegseth, in particular, the meme that he shared on Twitter and elsewhere using the children's character Franklin, a talking turtle, striking narco-terrorists. It is not simply offensive and stupid. It is fundamentally so adolescent. It is almost, it's of a piece with him declaring the Department of Defense the Department of War and screwing in the nameplate in front of the building and charging taxpayers $2 billion so that he can cosplay as the Secretary of War rather than the Secretary of Defense. He is an abomination in the Trump cabinet, and there's a lot of people in there who just are like willfully denying reality in order to like score clout with their boss and with natcons on Twitter. It's a very, very disturbing and despicable aspect to Pete Hegseth.
Catherine, there was a Wall Street Journal story over the weekend that I flagged in our Slack that was basically about defense technology manufacturers who had built a lot of stuff for fighting the war on terror in the Middle East. But it seems like now a lot of that is being used for this narco-terror war, which is it's a war, but it's not a declared war. But basically, it's being used to fight the war on drugs. Is there like an axiom or something, like something you've learned in your time editing a Reason magazine about the war on terror and the war on drugs?
Yeah, it's almost as if power is given to the state in order to fight the war on terror will eventually be used to stop people from getting high or getting laid. And here we are. We might even call it Mengu Ward's Law. The other thing I want to note about this whole thing, which is, I know that the Trump administration does not care about internal consistency, and actually that like most people don't care about internal consistency. And so in that, they have much in common with the American public. But it is quite wild to me that we are in a situation where, OK, we have some guys who might be bringing drugs on boats somewhere. Not even clear it's really going to the United States, but let's posit that it is, hypothetically. Historically, the process has been that you interdict, you catch those people, maybe you try them in a court of law. Now, if we had done that, then maybe a bunch of them would get long prison sentences, like, I don't know, the former president of Honduras, who Trump announced this weekend that he had the intention to pardon him because he was treated very unfairly for a conspiracy to import cocaine and the possession of machine guns. He had 45 years in prison. It doesn't make any sense. We're destroying with lightning from the skies the lowest level guys on boats schlepping some cocaine to Trinidad or whatever they're doing, and meanwhile pardoning kingpins, if you are to believe the allegations in every direction. It just seems like someone somewhere should be like, wait a minute. But I guess that's not going to happen.
Matt, did you see this new White House webpage on the Media Offenders of the Week, which is currently focused on the spat between Trump and the Democrats over this ad that a Democratic Senator Alyssa Slotkin produced, in which she was like, hey, you don't have to follow illegal orders that violate the Constitution, right? And so the Trump administration put together this like list of publications: the Boston Globe, CBS News, The Independent, as Media Offenders of the Week, right? Accused them of not accurately portraying Trump's remarks, right? And then there's also all of this just like a legacy page of offenders, in which they're like, the Washington Post is the worst. Does that? I don't know. What do you make of that? And like, what does that tell us about when allegations like this when reports like this get published with allegations about the Trump administration's behavior? Pete Hegseth responds with memes, and the White House responds with, actually, you're the bad guy, media.
Yeah, there's a tweet I saw from, I think, a secretary or a deputy press secretary from the Department of War. That said, that the fake news, capitalized, of course, again, and also phony politicians, interesting characterization, are guilty once again of are wrong about this because, and then bullet points, you know, this action was completely legal. Like, we gotta have the adverbs. Like this, not just completely legal. This was totally legal.
Well, that's better than barely legal, I suppose.
I think it's not better. I think we're objectively pro. Yeah.
Really? Okay. I mean, it's just what we expect. But also, It's an excuse to not have an argument. I've been writing for Reason magazine now for 20 years on the subject of how anti-media animus is kind of the glue that brings together at any given time the Republican coalition, and that that animus sometimes leads to pretty good preliminary insight about bias, but leads to pretty bad insight about agenda, or at least bad until 5-6 years ago when the media started losing its damn fool mind and talking about moral clarity and a bunch of other crap. But that in doing so, you no longer needed to have the kind of argument. When Tucker Carlson went to CPAC 12 years ago and said, we need a new New York Times, and that's why I'm going to start the Daily Caller, he was sincere back then. What he meant by the New York Times is that we needed a place that had as much commitment, at least to a base level of professionalism and correcting its mistakes and so on. The right hasn't produced those institutions nearly as much as Tucker Carlson would have pretended. And Tucker Carlson himself has gone across the many different bends since then. And so you just gets to this place where people are satisfied by just saying fake news, must be wrong, total agenda, next question. You don't have to actually interrogate the questions. And this will be, you know, this can be somewhat successful, but so far the public has not been excited about the president just deciding he can murder people in the Caribbean. And I take that as actually heartening and surprising, because the public has been in sort of a Jacksonian mood for a pretty long time, a populist move, get off our lawn. And many people see the Caribbean and the sort of near abroad of America as part of our lawn, and we can kind of do what we want. But so far, that hasn't worked. So you can work in the short term, but also Donald Trump is 2 points off his all-time low in popularity per Gallup. And that all-time low was measured after January 6th, 2021, in which he behaved very badly on that day. I don't know if you guys remember that. So, you can get away with it. You can do this kind of stuff. But ultimately, you are sowing the seeds of really, really significant future failure for the Republican Party, as long as people remember how spineless Republican politicians, with the exception of one or two people, have been throughout his reign atop the GOP.
Yeah, if I may, we've already seen the beginning of that. We've talked about this, I think, but with the elections a few weeks ago, you saw the glimmerings of this, where Republicans did not do particularly well in any place where there was a matchup. Trump, it is always worth remembering, and certainly his minions are, you know, have learned this lesson. When the economy is doing poorly and when people are unhappy with you, you know, blow stuff up or start becoming very incendiary so that people start talking about anything. I mean, the reason Trump is now in the process, supposedly, of releasing the Epstein files, I think, is because the economy, people are uncomfortable with it, and people don't like what Donald Trump is doing. So he is, you know, trying to distract people with more and more bullshit. It may work for him, but it's going to come a cropper for the Republican Party, in the same way that Barack Obama, you know, when he left office, he had pretty good approval ratings and things like that, but he had destroyed his party by pursuing an increasingly unpopular agenda throughout his time in the White House. Trump is doing that in his own way, and it'll have the same results.
Since Matt mentioned things that we are not having arguments about, but are happening anyway, let's talk a little bit about legal hemp, which is soon to be illegal hemp. You guys remember the government shutdown? Well, when they passed a bill to reopen the government, they buried in it a provision that basically means that products that have any kind of hemp intoxication in them are illegal now. And right, this is going to do huge damage to the growing legal hemp industry, right? The things like THC beverages, gummies, other consumable CBD products. So, Catherine, we published a story about this at Reason.com. It's really good. You want to tell us a little bit about the story about Brittany Hunter, and just why, more generally, are we returning to prohibition?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is actually a great example of political risk having economic consequences, right? Because this is a case where this was just chucked into this funding bill. It was like a maximally chaotic time in Washington. Certainly no thoughtful debate was given to this. And it's going to wipe out, potentially wipe out, you know, a lot of companies, including a lot of small businesses that opened up, invested in American, you know, if you want to America first, it, like, we're growing the hemp here. And they invested in good faith with the understanding that their line of business had been legally ratified by the 2018 Farm Bill. And that's just kind of rolled back because I don't know why drugs are bad. And the piece, which is by a writer from the Pacific Legal Foundation, which has taken the case of one or maybe a small group of folks who use hemp to produce CBD products and other things, you know, they make the excellent case that this is a growth industry. It's, you know, they're doing everything they can do to be in conformity with all the other regulations that apply to them. They're, you know, and they're like this company, which is called Cornbread, confusingly, they have like all this fancy smancy organic, you know, not a single pesticide has ever so much as looked at the land where they're growing the cannabis. And, but
it's like the vermouth in a classic martini
where you just wave it over. Yeah. So the new provision says that there can be no more than 0.4 milligrams of THC in the entire container of any CBD product. And that's really, really, really hard to do. And so it basically just casually makes this entire business and many like it illegal.
Yeah. The stat from that piece was that this could effectively ban 95% of hemp products that are currently on the market. It's bad. It's stupid. We were making progress. This is a bad way to go. All right. We're gonna take a little break here and come back with a good way to go, which is a listener question after this. The holidays are hectic. Family drama, last minute shopping, late nights. All of this can make the holidays feel like an endurance test. That's why I am sharing the ultimate holiday survival plan, CBD from CB Distillery. Seriously, everything you need for a merry holiday is right here. You can stuff mom's stocking with CBD for better sleep. Gift your fitness friends a pain relief stick for post-workout pain. And don't forget to grab a little bit of holiday calm for yourself. Every CBD Distillery product is made with premium quality, clean ingredients, no fillers, nothing artificial. And with over 2 million customers and a 100% money back guarantee, it's the gift you can feel good about giving. Or for that matter, getting, because if you're like me and you have your own personal podcast running all day long in your head, well, sometimes that makes it tough to sleep, which you really need during the holidays. So trust me, this is a good way to turn down your own brain volume. This year, give yourself and everyone on your list the gift of better sleep, less stress, pain relief with CBD from CB Distillery. And with my promo code REASON, you can save 25% off your entire purchase. Visit cbdistillery.com and enter code REASON for 25% off. That's cbdistillery.com, code REASON, cbdistillery.com. Specific product availability depends on individual state regulations. All right, as a reminder, remember, we love to answer your questions. So send your short, succinct, pithy, and not very long question to podcasts@reason.com. We answer them every week, as well as on the webathon that is coming up this Thursday, 2:30 p.m. Eastern on YouTube. This week's listener question comes from Jack, who writes, I am a Trump voting libertarian who usually votes single issue free minds, free markets. I recently had a heated conversation with a good friend about ICE, that's the immigration authority, not the stuff you put in your cocktail, coming to Charlotte over a few beers. I was forced to do some soul searching and stumbled upon a Reason article on this topic. I cynically dismissed the raids as a party agnostic federal power issue. But after reviewing the facts, it seems to me that there is a pretty clear abuse of constitutional law by a border force poorly tempered by the courts. In your experience, is there a Rubicon being crossed here? Is Trump still flapping around in the gray area? Matt Welch, what do you think about the ICE raids in Charlotte and elsewhere?
Can I just first say that this question asker, I do think, even if he didn't name Matt in the question, by asking if the Rubicon was crossed in a flappy gray area, he has essentially named Matt.
Yeah, so I was invoked.
Go ahead.
Fun fact, the Rubicon is or was a small river in Italy. At which Julius Caesar in 49 BC was thinking, like, do I cross this bridge here and therefore go against the wishes of the Roman Senate and then, like, go to war and then do the totalitarianism? And after he crossed, he said, hey, the die is cast. It's done. It's since been seen as a kind of analogy for making a fateful and irreversible decision. So in that context, the question is, what would have been the moment in which there was a fateful and irreversible decision? I can think of two that are prominent. One is in 1976 in the Supreme Court case, the United States versus, I think, Martinez Fuente, in which by a 7-2 decision, the Supreme Court said that basically the Border Patrol, as it was then known, could conduct internal checkpoints. Internal checkpoints, people. We've had this in our country now for 50 years, where within 100 miles of the international border, which is a level set by the 1952 Immigration Nationality Act or whatever it was called, Naturalization Act, 100 miles, they could just like sit on I-5 in Southern California and say, yeah, come on over. I think you might be illegally somebody and check you over. And the Supreme Court said that's not an unreasonable search and seizure to do a checkpoint in, you know, 75, 66 miles from the border. So that was a bad moment because it said that we could have a internal policing mechanism that could ask for your legal status. It was the papers please moment. 2/3 of Americans live within 100 miles of an international border. Charlotte is more like 175 miles. So yes, that seems like more than 100. But also this comes to the second Rubicon crossing moment, I would suggest, which is in 2015 when Donald Trump came into our political lives, and his opening salvo was that Mexico is not sending their best, they're sending rapists, that they're emptying their prisons, that it's worse than the Mariel boat lift, and that he was uniquely, this was going to be his signature issue. And along the way, as he ran for that for president, I immediately rocketed to the top of the GOP polls on that rhetoric. He said things like he would be in favor of deporting the 4 million American illegal immigrant children and denaturalizing citizens, withdrawing legal status for many people. So when he presented himself for who he was, and given that the Supreme Court, in not just the 76 decision, but in other decisions, had given the president wide latitude to do things with immigration law without much check from the Congress, those were the moments when the Rubicon was crossed. We should not, if we are paying close attention, act in surprise that this is happening in 2025, given that he has run for president and received votes from a lot of well-meaning people twice on this signature issue while expressing zero or something even less than zero sense of personal and professional constraint by the Constitution. Those are the Rubicon crossings. And yeah, you should be worried.
Nick, what do you think about this?
Here is a place where recourse to data is extremely helpful. David Beer at the Cato Institute has looked at the arrest records of people that Trump is, you know, is, or ICE is picking up under Trump. 5% of the people detained by ICE since he's taken office had violent crime convictions. 75% had no convictions whatsoever. The other ones who did it was stuff like traffic stops, where, you know, they got traffic tickets. They were late on certain immigration appointments, things like that. 3% had property crime convictions against them. So Trump campaigned specifically on getting rid of the bad hombres, of the people who were, you know, violent criminals among illegals in America. Kristi Noem says this on an almost daily basis. And the fact of the matter is that what ICE, the people that ICE is rounding up, overwhelmingly have no criminal convictions, no violent convictions against them, and no criminal convictions whatsoever. So on the face of this, this is horrible. It might be consistent with Trump's general vibe, which that he hates immigrants. Most recently, he has talked about getting rid of like more and more immigrants, all immigrants, getting people to, you know, self-deport and whatnot. But this is not only bad policy, it's also unpopular policy. The same thing happened during Trump's first term. The more that he cracked down on immigrants who are generally speaking here legally and who are coming here to work and to better their lives and the lives of their children, and the way they do this is by performing valuable services and providing goods, you know, goods that people want at prices they can afford. In Trump's first term, You saw a record high number of Americans agree with the idea that immigration is good for the country. He has just hit that number again, and we're not even a year into his second term. So in a bizarre way, the worse that Trump gets, the more inhumane and the more despicable he gets in treating people as if they are subhuman, he ends up hurting his own cause. And I hope that the courts, when they rule on this sort of stuff, and when the Senate and the House of Representatives find a backbone, maybe they can import one. It'll cost extra because of the tariffs. But, you know, when they finally get a backbone, they will shut this down.
So Nick says that this is unpopular policy, and I think that's right in a lot of ways. But don't you worry, Catherine, that Trump's now in his second term. He is no longer, he doesn't have to pay attention to public opinion in the same way that he used to, because he's not up for election again. And in fact, just this last week or two, you've started to see Republicans, at least on background, kind of murmur that they worry that he is not leading the party well and doesn't care about the future of the party, almost certainly true, because he's no longer constrained by public opinion in the way that he, say, was in his first term.
My general take on intra-Republican strife is the same as my take on intra-Democratic strife, which is like, let them fight. Like, I don't, whatever. But
it does have implications here
for
things like immigration enforcement.
I do think there are a couple things that Trump actually cares about. One is he likes to do tariffs, and one is that he does want to kick out a lot of immigrants. And those are the things that he told us he cared about when he ran the first time, and he's going to do them until he is forced to stop doing them when he leaves office, please God, at the end of this term, peacefully. And, you know, I think that this question was mostly, I think, about ICE and kind of immigration enforcement. But there are two other places, I think, where Trump is kind of pushing harder than his predecessors have, even those who are functionally immigration restrictionists. One is an attempt to roll back birthright citizenship. That used to be pretty uncontroversial, bipartisan, kind of agreed upon thing. And the other is skilled immigration, which that has been more debatable. But, you know, there's so much going on with immigration. It has gone mostly unnoticed that Trump has imposed enormous fees on H-1Bs and has put into place a lot of other restrictions on high-skilled or otherwise previously uncontroversial immigration categories. So that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that can be maybe technically within his ambit and also will be a little tricky to undo.
All right. Before we get to our cultural recommendations, I want to have a cultural segment. Let's talk a little bit about playwright Tom Stoppard, who died over the weekend. He was a titan of drama. I mean, just one of the most revered playwrights the last 100 years, certainly of his generation. He's a great script doctor. In addition to writing plays, he did things like punch up the screenplay for Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. If you go online, you could actually look at the difference between the original script and the script after he worked on it. It's obviously so much better. And the important thing about him is he wasn't just a great in terms of being a writer and recognized a great. He was one of us in a real way. He was an ardent supporter of free speech. He dedicated a play to Vaclav Havel. He expressed support for Margaret Thatcher. And at times he called himself a timid libertarian. So Matt Welch, I know you are a fan. You have some interest in him. Tell us about his legacy, what you see from Tom Stoppard.
I'm a qualified fan because I'm not a huge consumer of the dramaturgical arts. It's a word. But fan of the man and avid consumer of at least two of his plays, one of which is, I think, the first play that I ever read, which is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, which is his first one in the 60s. And just like a dazzling, hilarious, literary kind of tap dance. He had this sense. He was born in Czechoslovakia, in Moravia, on the central part of the country back then, and left as a two-year-old, I think, as a refugee before the Nazis and other bad guys showed up, and then lived his life in England and kind of kept some partial interest in his Czech roots. He didn't fully know until the 90s that those were Jewish roots and that four of his grandparents were killed in the Holocaust. That led to his last, and some people say greatest, certainly a very interesting play in 2020 called Leopoldstadt. But he was always connected to the dissident movement in Central Europe, in Russia and Czechoslovakia in particular. He visited both the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia in 1977, when it wasn't that easy to do so, and met with Václav Havel back then, when Havel was a frequently jailed playwright himself, also sort of a literary trickster, playing on words. And he supported the beginning of Charter 77, the most, I think, influential, profound, anti-communist, anti-authoritarian movement ever, started by Václav Havel back then. And Stoppard was kind of this vanishing breed of a figure. That, you know, it's funny to watch all these 30-year-old idiot LARPers in Washington, D.C., elbowing for position in the Claremont Institute or the Heritage Foundation, talking about saving Western civilization, when you had this entire group, genre of people who were very conscious about the problems of Western civilization, but also the sort of the hope from it, that they were wrestling with the torments of the 20th century of totalitarianism. He wrote a half a dozen plays about free speech, wrote them about Soviet Union, translated Havel's Largo Desolado, which was also dedicated to him. He helped all this dissident literature happen. It was the subject of a lot, but not the entirety of his work. And this was sort of like the New York Review of Books liberal category. People who in the 1980s would probably consider themselves left of center and super ardent anti-communists. And that's a memory that we're forgetting. And he's also just very, like, in that sense of English as a second language, so playful with maximizing what you could do, like Vladimir Nabokov was and other people who wrote in English later. Sort of combine all of these things. So he's just sort of a giant. Many people said he's the greatest, British playwright. I can't judge that, but certainly a towering man who worked with a lot of interesting people and was just sitting there in the middle of the 20th century wrestling with it and producing great and interesting works, including what I'll throw in later on in the in our culture recommendations, which is the rock and roll play from 2006, which is marvelous.
If I may, I would recommend if people are interested in checking him out, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. I think everybody comes across that at some point, either in high school or college, and it's really fresh and amazing, right? Because it riffs off of minor characters in Shakespeare and creates a whole new world. And that's kind of the exercise that Stoppard, you know, gave to us, which is the idea that you can create your own world, which is so fundamentally libertarian and so pro-freedom. I'm a big fan of Acadia, what is considered one of his major plays. And it is a fascinating kind of time shift between contemporary times and the early 19th century. And again, building on what Matt was talking about, sometimes you need people who feel or are outsiders to the culture that they end up inhabiting to fully kind of figure out what are the rules, what is possible, and how to expand those boundaries in all sorts of interesting ways, and how to synthesize the past and tradition with innovation and change, which I think is fundamentally, that is kind of the libertarian conundrum. I think Stoppard fits into the category of a kind of Promethean libertarianism. You know, this, he's not doctrinaire. He was timid at best. He was kind of a Thatcher supporter and things like that. He liked free markets, but is, you know, no Murray Rothbard or anything. But more fundamentally, what it's about is that we are born in a time and place, and how do we make that place a little bit larger and a little bit more interesting and a little bit more free? And it is frustrating as hell to see the rise of kind of nitwit national conservatives or right-wingers who have absolutely no connection to the culture that they claim that they are saving, and they will put down somebody like a Tom Stoppard and claim that somebody like Vladimir Putin is the answer to what ails Western civilization, as opposed to the last remaining tumor of a cancer that almost brought the whole thing down.
I would just add quickly, Peter, that one of Stoppard's last lengthy interviews, he talked at some length about what he saw as very worryingly illiberal trends in free speech in England, which is the country that he eventually identified the most with. And he exulted in those freedoms and believed, like a very true liberal, that those freedoms were why ultimately liberalism is going to win over authoritarianism. And he just worried that, and I think he was right, that authoritarianism was creeping back into British life, English life.
I'll also just give a little shout out. You know, I, as Nick mentioned, encountered Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead at some point in high school. And it's my first memory, at least, of being in on an intellectual joke. I think, you know, it's like the thing about Stoppard is that he's an elitist, but he's like an open door elitist, or he's kind of like a welcoming elitist or something like that, because it's, you know, you get this sort of feeling of being a part of a conversation that maybe was previously not available, certainly not to, you know, a 15-year-old in Alexandria, Virginia in public school, but maybe actually to everyone, because even 15-year-olds in Alexandria, Virginia in public school read his work. And I think there's something extremely impressive and rare about that.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, yeah, was I encountered it in high school on the competitive drama circuit.
I hate
it was
you
a
so much.
Favorite of the nerdy teenagers who went to forensics competitions and performed these things often as sort of little one man plays. But then I didn't have any too much exposure to his plays until later in my 30s when I actually got to see Acadia here in D.C. with the late great Terry Teachout, who took me and my wife to a version of that play, and I was blown away. I still am. I still think about that that night. I don't see nearly enough live theater. One of the great regrets of my adult life. But that play it's so wonderful. There's so much depth and emotion to it, which is sort of contrary to this sort of early idea of him that he was just intellectual, all head and no heart. But there is also just this delight in the form and in language itself. And this is, I think, the thing reading about him that really stood out to me is, yes, later in his life, he became somewhat more political, but he was not driven by the sense that art should be essentially op-ed writing, you know, in theater form. This was not a devotee of Bertolt Brecht who wanted a theater to be like two lawyers arguing on the stage and then the audience leaves, moved to action, right? He was someone who wrote because he loved language, because he loved words for their own sake, right? There's this great thing that he wrote in the Sunday Times of London in 1968. Some writers write because they burn with a cause, which they further by writing about it. I burn with no causes. I cannot say that I write with any social objective. One writes because one loves writing, really. And that came through in every single sentence he wrote, even the ones he wrote for the Star Wars movies and Indiana Jones. All right, let's move on to our actual cultural recommendations here. Matt Welch, do you want to continue this just a little bit by recommending something by Tom Stoppard?
Yeah, just I want to name, as they say in certain circles, I just want to name that Peter Suderman not only talked about competitive theater, but he used the phrase earlier on this very podcast of antitrust hipsters, which is my way of saying that Peter Suderman needs to be shot into the sun. Anyways,
you can live in Washington, D.C.,
I saw this play that I'm holding up to the screen, Rock and Roll by Tom Stoppard, in Washington, D.C., back when it was running. It's no longer playing, I don't think, anywhere, but it played all over the world. Whatever is the opposite of the Gell-Mann amnesia hypothesis, Catherine, is what happens when you consume a work of art or a piece of journalism about something that you know really, really well. That could be like one of the first things that you ever wrote in any length, including into Reason Magazine. He wrote about it, and he wrote about it better and more accurately and more interestingly and more movingly than anything I could have ever imagined. So that was his take, Rock and Roll, about kind of the plastic people, rock and roll band in Czechoslovakia, whose arrest and trial was the kind of the moment that Václav Havel said, I just don't care anymore. It's now disgraceful to live quietly. I'm going to live loud and to hell with these. And this is a direct quote, these cunning little shits in the communist government. And so this piece is about it starts about that, but it's told from the perspective of a Czech student who had been studying in, Cambridge in the UK, goes back home in 68, and then stays there when the Soviets come in and crush the Prague Spring. And he kind of is interacting with all these dissidents. But it's also about his professor, who's a Marxist and an idealized and idealistic Marxist. And he is told, that person is portrayed in a really empathetic and identifiable way. Everybody in the play who has all these different things that come about to them that are forced to the surface by all the events of the world are presented in such humanistic and realistic ways. It's just a stunning piece. And again, about kind of the liberating force of rock and roll and in fighting authoritarianism. Just tremendous rock and roll. You can get it like a lot of Stoppard's plays. It's very fun to read as a book because it's just a lot of good dialogue. So check it out. It's one of the favorite things I've ever seen live.
Check it out. Yeah. Nick Gillespie, what do you have for us?
I went to see a contemporary smash Broadway play, Oh Mary, which is by Cole Escola. And it's a long one-act play about Mary Todd Lincoln that figures her as an alcoholic, adulterer, and Abraham Lincoln as a gay man. It is a piss take on American history. And, a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Ken Burns about the American Revolution and about history. And I thought a lot about, you know, what does the past mean to us while watching Oh Mary? Jane Krakowski of, I guess, Ally McBeal, as well as 30 Rock, is the star, who's just incredible. This is a play that destroys any possible concept of history. It goes beyond camp to something I'm not even sure quite how to interpret, other than that, for it to exist and for it to be popular and for it to have its run extended. It started off Broadway a few years ago, moved to Broadway, I think, in 2024, and is continuing there, is a sign that we actually live in an unbelievably rich and tolerant society. And I'm all for that. So that's what Oh Mary with an exclamation point is about.
Let me offer a counterpoint or maybe a sort of supplemental reading to Nick's, which is for our long drive for Thanksgiving. My family listened to a couple episodes of The Rest is History podcast. In case you're wondering what it's like to be my child, that's what it's like. We sometimes have to listen to 3 hours of a two-part series on the assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
It is one of the funniest two-part podcasts of all time.
So good.
Yeah.
They are. It's very, very funny. It's Tom Holland and Dominic Sandbrook. Not that Tom Holland and also not that Tom Holland, but another Tom Holland. Just two dudes shooting the shit about history in a way that particularly in this episode, they're just like, it's not too late to dunk on John Wilkes Booth is right. Kind of their angle.
Although and they kind of also dunk on Major Andre, right? And virtually everybody involved, even Abraham Lincoln. It's a delight for sure.
They remain broadly unimpressed with the aptitude of almost every player in the story. And rightly so, at least after having listened.
Catherine, do you also want to tell us about sexy foxes and or gazelles?
Thank you for asking. I
gazelles.
Do. So in addition to listening to history podcasts in the car, my entire family, I think there were 11 or 12 of us in the end, went to Zootopia 2. And it's pretty good, guys. Zootopia 1, truly excellent film, if I may say. All the animals are a little too sexy. Just a little too sexy.
Too sexy.
Not right? A lot.
This is like an Anthony.
Too sexy, especially Shakira, no? Who plays a gazelle, who sings the kind of theme song of the movie. I thought that it was ultimately a movie about eminent domain. My sister thought it was about Gaza. And you should go see it and decide.
Wow.
The snakes have a neighborhood in the city and they're forced out. Matt, are they going to come back?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you better.
I'm the one who thinks The Wicked 2 is really about Animal Farm. So I'm here for your contrarian
takes. Okay. You're picking up what I'm putting down.
That's the power of art, folks. So I read The Tainted Cup. It's a new novel, a newish novel by Robert Jackson Bennett. It's a Holmes and Watson style murder mystery. And it's set in a fantasy realm that is beset by leviathans that are kept out by a wall along the ocean, right? And there's a whole kind of complicated government infrastructure that's just really about keeping the big monsters from breaking through the wall and destroying civilization. They have these different castes that have different gene modifications. And this might sound familiar to you because this book was recommended on this podcast just a couple of weeks ago by Jerusalem Demsis. And now I really understand why, because when you get to the very, very end of the book, and this is not really a spoiler, there is an author's note.
I swear to God, Peter. So I am three quarters of the way through this book, and I will cut you.
All right, folks, that's our show. Before we go, Nick, do you have any big announcements or personal news that you want to share with us?
Yes, I do, Peter. Thank you for asking. I am going to be going on a 2-month parental leave as my wife and I are expecting a child imminently. Woo-hoo. So I will hopefully see you all at the beginning of February 2026, if there is a country and a podcast still.
There will be. We have hope.
We'll keep it together while you're gone.
We have a parade of guest stars who will be sitting in your chair, though no one will truly be able to take your place. Congratulations, seriously, and good luck, and we'll see you in a couple of months. All right, before we go, final reminder, send your webathon questions to podcast@reason.com. Please label them webathon, and remember to tune in this Thursday, 2:30 p.m. Eastern on YouTube. We also have a debate coming up, Reason Versus, next week here in Washington, D.C. at the Miracle Theater. We're going to be debating big tech. Elizabeth Nolan Brown and Robbie Suave will be for it, and Emily Jashinsky and Ryan Grimm will be against it. That is December 10th, Wednesday, next week at the Miracle Theater in Washington, D.C. You can get tickets at reason.com/versus. As always, if you like this podcast, support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you all so much for listening. The Reason Roundtable will return.